It happened almost 60 years ago, but the debate still rages. Did an alien spacecraft crash outside Roswell, New Mexico in 1947?
This is how we're going to kind of keep this very quiet so that higher authority can handle it. Is that what happened?
Pretty much so. I couldn't find anything to admit.
You have said that it was definitely not a weather balloon. What do you think it was?
I don't really know. I'm not certain of the whole thing. I feel that there's been information released that maybe shouldn't be released.
Can you kind of remember about how big it was? How much space it took up in the hangar?
I would venture a guess that probably a diameter of somewhere around 25 feet.
When you saw the body in the hangar, partially covered with a tarp. You only saw the one.
Yes.
People have said that you have seen the debris field, and you deny that.
No. I've seen the debris field. At that time, I did not see it.
In 1947, you didn't see it.
Didn't see it.
That was Walter Haupt talking. Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Pippin. And welcome to our Roswell preview show number 2. I would like to thank Wendy Connors right off the bat for her help on the Walter Haupt opening and the soundbite, fadeddisc.com. And by the way, we have a pretty much an exclusive of Walter talking about what he actually saw later in the show. So stay tuned. This is our second in our series of Roswell shows. We're going to present both sides this time. Later in the program, we're going to have a man, William Lime, who was with the Air Force Security, and he is going to say no aliens at all. Nothing like that ever happened, on and on and on. You'll find his interview fairly interesting. One of the things I found out about it that I thought was interesting was how many people have spent a lot of time, and the U.S. government has spent a lot of money trying to debunk things. So that alone makes it seem like there's something happening. And Larry Dickin is with us, our executive producer, our resident UFO expert again. And Larry, on yesterday's show, we talked about Walter Haupt and the affidavit, and we'll get back into that in a moment. But really, I think there's a preponderance of evidence that Roswell probably was visited by aliens due to a UFO crash of some sort.
Well, it would certainly seem so, Jerry. One, you know, this story has been investigated, talked about, written about, TV shows done about for the past 40, almost into 50 years. You know, there was some period of time from 1947 up through 57 when not a lot was said about it, but after that, things started to cook a little bit. But it really was not until authors like Stanton Friedman and Kevin Randall and, of course, Tom Casey and Don Smith, all these various parties began to write books and do research on this. And I know Stanton started his work back in the 1980s. And
and if anybody wants to know about that, we have a very interesting interview of Stanton that's been there for some time on his page about how he discovered
right.
it.
But I can certainly remember when I was a young man, God, when was that? But back in the 1960s, reading, you know, stories about Roswell, and these weren't full investigations. These were mainly anecdotal stories that were being told in various books written about UFOs at the time. And, of course, as time went on, serious research ensued. And but after all of this time, the story still remains extremely confusing. The fact that an ET craft, or perhaps even two craft, crashed in the state of New Mexico during the first week of July in 1947, I think the evidence for that is pretty overwhelming in terms of eyewitness accounts that corroborate with each other.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the things that's really difficult to deal with. Of course, it's been 60 years coming up here in July, either 3rd or 4th. We'll talk about that as well. No one really knows the date, do they?
No, they don't. You know, I have even heard stories, and I can't quote a particular researcher. However, Stanton pretty well covered all the bases in his crash at Corona, in terms of the various time frames and possibilities, and the fact that Brazil was brought in, you know, from the debris site area. He wasn't brought in, he brought himself into Roswell, and however, once he got there and made his report, he was sequestered at the police station for several days, and when he came out, his story had changed a little bit. So, you know, this added some more confusion to the matter. Of course, that was part of the government cover-up with
Yeah, well, we're not even sure where his ranch was, is where the major activity
right.
was.
And
we'll get into that also
right.
in a moment.
So,
we held up this show because we were waiting for another lead we had, and it's just like most of the others. The man was sincere telling us the story, but here again, he was 8 years old at the
right.
time. And so, it's just hard to
right.
verify when you have 60
right.
years.
Right, except for the fact that it did corroborate other eyewitness accounts, and that's what's important. The more eyewitness accounts that you have with independent witnesses that definitely have no acquaintance with each other, the more important their testimony is.
Now you talked to Don Schmidt, he was telling you that there's several eyewitness accounts in this new book.
Oh, many new ones. That, and again, as I said, cooperation is what's important here. This is what really nails it down as being something that definitely happened and was definitely covered up. Let me retrogress just briefly on the date issue so that we can make sure that people understand the time frame here. Is that the crash scenarios, and there are multiple scenarios, and we'll discuss that shortly, occurred in the time frame from July 2nd through July 4th, and somewhere between 11:30 and midnight on each of those nights. Now, the July 2nd date comes into play because on that night there was a reported sighting of a disc overflying the town of Roswell itself.
Now, this is the nuns,
right.
story, right?
And, of course, there are various experts that question the fact that these people were telling the truth. The only thing is that I think they were telling the truth on what they saw, but this really had nothing to do with the crash. In other words, this was just another UFO sighting. However, there were some people who tried to connect the nun sighting of the UFO passing over Roswell with the actual crash north of Roswell.
The thing, and it'll come clear here as we talk about these crash sites, the plains of St. Augustine, if that was this part of the same crash, it was pretty far away, but it was near the same date.
Yes, it was.
So what I'm trying to say is maybe there were several UFOs in that area during the time, and I think originally in an inter-office memo to you, I said that really strains credibility. You could have two UFO crashes within a couple of days or a 24-hour period, but hey, it's possible.
It certainly is. And I have, you know, my own personal opinions on this matter, and I sort of think that indeed there potentially were two independent crashes, but you know, whether the experts will agree with me on that remains to be seen. But again, back to the dates, I mentioned July 2nd and some of the things that justified that date, but July 3rd is a very strong candidate for the crash at Roswell, up in you know, between Roswell and Corona, but July 4th is also an equal favorite among various experts and researchers and the local residents in Roswell. In fact, I think we were told by one of our sources that July 4th is currently the big favorite date. Why? Because it's Independence Day.
It's also the beginning of the Roswell 60th anniversary celebration.
Right, that helps.
When I say that, I'm not jumping in on the side of the debunkers and saying the town's gone wild on merchandising thing. It's only natural that they should be merchandising this thing. I think the city of Roswell has actually done a favor to the nation by keeping this alive.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, keeping this story alive is that over the years, we've managed to, those of us involved in the field of ufology have managed to beat the U.S. government into the ground on this issue. They have tried a number of times to cover this up, and each time they have been quite unsuccessful, and it seems like each attempt to cover it up, and you'll remember the last thing with the Project Mogul balloon and the crash dummies falling out of airplanes, each one gets more and more ridiculous. So it's almost, I don't think there's very many people out there in the whole United States or around the world that believe the government story. I think most people believe that something really happened. And
let's talk about the four crash sites, if you don't mind, because a lot of people aren't really familiar with the idea that there might be four. Two was pretty foreign to me.
Right. Well, this is true. I mean, the story is somewhat more complex than it might appear on the surface, because part of the government disinformation that started literally right after the recovery of the craft was the fact that the crash site where a flying disc was reported to have been found by the U.S. military, and this went out on the news wire. Okay, and Mr. Hout is the one that put the press release out.
And they need to go listen to our first show in the series, the preview number one show, because we deal with that affidavit in detail. And what Walter's saying there is pretty much standard operating procedure, especially for the military, and that's redirection.
Right. And what they did was came out with the initial story, and this was approved by his commander at the Army airfield there in Roswell.
Like Colonel Blanchard.
Right. And that was indeed that a disc was recovered. This is something, you know, not ours. And, you know, after all of the other sightings around the country in the same year of 1947, you know, I mean, this is when the modern era of UFOs actually began, even though there were just as many in the early 40s and during World War II. But, you know, 47 seems to be the year in which there really were mass sightings all over the United States in that year. It wasn't just to Roswell.
To our David Sarita interview on the previous show, he talks about all those mass sightings. He lays them out pretty well.
Right. Now,
So we have the debris field, which was the ranch, right?
Yeah, well, I'm going to point out all of the different sites here and also associated with them the different possible scenarios for what happened.
Good.
In other words, was this a UFO crash, or was this a collision between two UFOs potentially, or were there two independent UFO crashes?
And then there's the other one that seems kind of far out, but people are floating it. Maybe it was a shoot down either by us or each other, or the ETs were shooting it at each other.
Right. I mean, you might have had two UFOs and they weren't the same ETs, you know, the same species, and they were shooting at each other. There have been reports of such things occurring over the years. Not frequently, but I have heard of sightings where one UFO would go chasing after another, and then one would appear to blow up in midair. So these things may occasionally happen. So here's the sites and the possible scenarios. We'll start out with the fact that over the ranch that Mr. Brazell was in charge of, the ranch hand manager there, on the night of either July 3rd or 4th, we'll take July 2nd out of the picture here, has a lot less support, that on either the 3rd or the 4th, somewhere between 11 o'clock and midnight, during a thunderstorm, which was small and isolated out by the ranch.
No sooner than we mentioned that on the broadcast, the previous broadcast about isolated thunderstorms.
Right.
We have one here. Roberta Scott called me, and she was only about a mile away, and it was sunshiny.
Right.
It was probably raining probably an inch an hour here.
That happens, yeah. Yes. So, at any rate, during this thunderstorm, there was a, what was reported by Brazell was a bright flash of light, and not just from lightning, although that was occurring at the time, but a brilliant flash of light and an explosion of some sort. And you can say, well, maybe you heard a loud clap of thunder. Well, you know, people can tell the difference between an explosion and thunder. So you have a bright flash of light and an explosion out over the ranch, right? And he went out the next morning to investigate, and he found all of this, quote, debris. And apparently it took him a couple of days. I think this was on a Sunday or something the next morning, so he had to wait till Monday to get into town. There was some delay before he was actually able to go in and report this. So you have what is called the debris field. Now, this was initially labeled in the press release from the military as being not just a debris field, but the actual crash site
flying disc. And that was done on purpose.
Yes. Because in actuality, there was another site where the real crash occurred. And this is one that is known as the Hob Corn site. It is right, just a couple of miles off of the main route north and south out of Roswell.
Is that the one we have the map on?
Yes.
Okay.
And people can refer to this map as we're telling this story, because you'll see the whole scenario here. Now that, I forget the number, that's a U.S. highway, I think it's 285 or something like that, but I'm not really sure.
Click over there and see.
Right. Well, this is an old map, sort of, and it really doesn't have the route number okay. on there in the right place. I can't really read it. At any rate, you know, it is, you'll see, a main road that goes up out of Roswell to the north, and you'll see a red circle, you know, a little spot there, and that, and there's be some arrows pointing at it, and that is the purported primary crash site. This is where bodies were found. A live ET was found, two bodies, and the craft itself, which was not a large disc-shaped object or any other kind of familiar UFO.
Yeah, yeah. On the opening, you hear Walter saying 25 feet,
right,
or so.
This is right, and that I think is a piece of disinformation as well. Because further research shows that this object that landed was actually some 12 to 15 feet across and only 6 feet high and was egg-shaped.
Well, you listen to him talking. He didn't sound really completely convinced how big it was.
Right.
He was insinuating it was small.
Well, he actually did get to see it in the hangar,
yes.
Remember? And I think in his 2002 affidavit, I think he concurs that it was much smaller than 25 feet.
Yeah, yeah, and we are going to, before we go any further, since we're talking to Walter, let's play this excerpt where he says he saw the one body.
Okay, and then I'll come back and comment on
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and that's coming out later. So listen to the late Walter Hout, and once again, we want to thank Wendy Connors, who has recordings of just about everything.
right.
Createdisc.com.
Well, I remember there was one body. It was a relatively small body, comparable to maybe a 10 or 11-year-old child. It was pretty well beat up.
Okay, that was Walter Hout, and not many people have heard that recording. It is available, by the way, on Wendy's website, Dennis Bell Thaser, and she interviewed Walter, and it's available.
Right, that was back in the year 2000.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is a whole nother account. Now, Walter has a history of revealing what he knows. And this started with his initial affidavit back in 1993. And then you have the interview with Dennis and Wendy, excuse me. And this was in 2000. And then you have the 2002 witnessed affidavit. This is the one that he said, don't reveal this until I pass away, and this was done. He passed away in December 2005, and during the year of 2006, Tom and Don were able to get access to this, and it is included in their book, and of course we have a link out to where you can read it for yourself. All of the different points that he's making about this is what I know about the case. And interestingly enough, in that affidavit from 2002, he makes the statement that he was taken by Colonel Blanchard to Hangar 84, and he was shown the craft and the bodies, although from a distance. So he could see that the craft was, as I said, somewhat small. It was not a disc. It was an egg-shaped object. some 12 to 15 feet in length and about 6 feet high. And whether it was damaged or not, that's an open question, but I've heard many stories saying that it was. It was literally, there was a crack in its side, and this allowed access to the craft, and the live ET was able to get out of the craft. And so he saw what his affidavit states, that he saw not one body, but he saw two under a tarpaulin, but their two heads were sticking out. He could not see any details on the face.
In fairness, when he said the one here on this tape we just played, Walter, when I met him was, I think, 2003, and he was not in good health at all then.
Right.
He barely could get down to the UFO Museum. And that's one reason we didn't do a show of him. He just wasn't up to it. I mean, physically.
Well, apparently he was in pretty good shape when he did the affidavit, but he knew that he was getting ill, and that's the reason he wanted to go on record. And so at any rate, you know, it makes no difference that his story changes slightly with time, because more and more detail is revealed as time progressed, and as he got near the end of his life, he wanted to tell as much of the truth as possible, and that's understandable as well. So whether it's one or two, two is certainly the right number to fit the scenario or the rest of the story. The fact that there were five coffins ordered, you know,
And we have the story with Glenn Dennis telling me that one of our UFO Roswell sections.
And that indicates that there were two bodies at the crash site, one live ET, and now we have to come up with three more bodies. Now that gets into the next part of the story. At the at the debris site, the story that Tom and Don are putting forth is the fact that this is something relatively new development here, but has a number of corroborating witnesses, is that there were three more bodies recovered, but they were not at another site. They, in the sense of being a crash site, in other words, there wasn't another escape capsule or pod or craft of any kind. There were just three bodies laying on the ground, not in very good shape, but certainly recognizable as bodies. Now remember, this this explosion of the craft, whether it was by collision or malfunction, occurred at a relatively low altitude over the ranch, and so the bodies were basically blown out of this craft, which was probably a disc, because that's what many of the craft during 1947 reported were, and you know, 25 to 30 feet across. Which goes along with the initial story that you were talking about from Walter about a 25-foot disc. And so if that exploded, these bodies were ejected out, and they were found 2.5 miles from the debris field. And so that totals up to five bodies, five caskets, and one live ET. Now, there's another interesting scenario, which a number of experts don't go along with, but the man swore right before he died that this was the absolute truth.
The Ragsdale impact site. That's actually at Lincoln National Forest at the foot of Sunset Peak.
And Mr. Ragsdale was out on... basically a back road, very back road, that he liked to take his girlfriends out to, and it was only a couple of miles at the most, probably one and a half, 2 miles from a little town called Annabelle. It had to be really little. And at any rate, that was the closest little town to this site, and he was out on a back road making out with his girlfriend, and they saw this object come in to the area and crash, and it was very close to them. They went over to investigate. He claims, as a part of his testimony, that he actually went up to a craft that was, as he describes it, very much like the escape pod that we mentioned at the other
site. Yeah, I have a quote in front of me. It was busted open. I crawled up, and they were still inside, the little people.
Right.
They didn't look
right.
Like us.
And he claims there were 3 bodies, okay? Now, those 3 bodies are the same 3 bodies that would have been close to the debris site in the other story. And again, 3 plus 2 equals 5. 5 caskets needed.
Right. Now, there's a 4th one, and that's the St. Augustine crash, where they found bodies, too, but we don't know anything about it. And that was 100 miles or so away.
And I know a little about it. And that's the fact that that crash could have been as a result of this collision, because no one saw the path of where this object came in. There were no observations of the event itself, only the after effects. That site is 100 miles west of Roswell, out in the plains of St. Augustine, in central New Mexico.
Now, has everybody agreed that happened on July 4th?
No.
Okay.
There are people that believe that the Roswell crash happened on July 4th, and some who believe July 3rd, and there are people who believe that the crash at St. Augustine occurred on July 3rd or 4th, depending upon which scenario you're talking about. If you're talking about the collision between 2 craft, rather than an explosion, then the date would be, you know, either July 3rd or July 4th. It could have happened either way. And the crash the remains out there in St. Augustine, again, it was a fairly small object that was recovered. And how many bodies? There were 4 bodies. How do we know about this? Because the military didn't say anything about it, obviously. And interestingly enough, there's no mention of this crash by anybody at Roswell Army Airfield. Walter Hout does not mention it. General Ramey does not mention it. The commander of the base does not mention it. That indicates that perhaps that was a separate event and had a separate recovery team, even though all of the stuff ended up in the same place eventually.
The time has got us here. You have some closing comments, and then we'll give the other side of the story with William Line.
Okay. Just before, one other thing. How many bodies were at that other site? They were reported as being 4. Okay? So that wouldn't add up to give the right total on the body count and the caskets. So to me, it was 2 separate occurrences.
Okay, you have some closing thoughts here.
Right. In my opinion, the investigation of the Roswell story is still not over. But it has now gotten down to arguments over details of what happened rather than arguments over whether a UFO with ETs on board really crashed or not. The proof is in that the event happened, but the full explanation of what actually happened on that night during the first week of July is still open to further investigation. It is like we all know that the Titanic sunk, but it was only recently that we learned what really happened that night of the sinking and what caused it to sink a few years ago. Unless the U.S. government presents the evidence that they have, the craft or crafts, the wreckage debris, the ET bodies, and the records of the government's research and analysis, and allow independent reanalysis, the real truth of what happened will never be known. However, I think the preponderance of the evidence now proves, after 60 years, that one or more craft containing ET entities did crash in the state of New Mexico during the first week of July 1947.
With that, we're going to have to close. Thanks very much, Larry Dickin. We have the other side coming up in the next segment with William Lyon. We'll have a continuing series here on Roswell, so we have lots of material for you folks. Coming back.
Welcome to the UFO Files Show with your host, Jerry Pippin.
William Lyon, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I'm very glad to be here, Jerry.
You're not far from here anyway, from Roswell.
Yeah, it's only 190 miles, something like that, 191 miles.
Now, you got an interesting book out. I guess you spend a little time saying in the book that you've never seen an ET.
Right, never have. But I've had a lot of people try to convince me, a lot of DIA agents, a lot of OSI agents.
Yeah, we were talking about all of that in front of you a while ago. I probably shouldn't have been talking out of school, but it's interesting. There's a few people on these cases from the government. It makes you wonder, I don't know what they know and what they don't know. And your thesis, I guess, is there's nothing to know.
Yeah, right. The government can actually deny the existence of alien UFOs and tell the truth, in my opinion. They're telling the truth. And everybody thinks they're lying because they've been brainwashed. By the other side, in other words, you have the official position. I call this the two-pronged system. The official position is they don't exist, and then they have a covert operation that said, well, if they do exist, they're out from outer space. So you have the most rational alternative in the middle that's being squeezed to death, that is that these things do exist, they're man-made, and all the other stuff about aliens
now,
is created
by
the government.
You were in the Air Force.
Yes.
Right. Do you see any evidence while you're in the service of these black projects? They're around, we know that.
Well, I even had people in there trying to convince me of aliens. But, you know, when I met Arthur C. Clarke in 1956, he was giving a speech at Keesler Air Force Base called Unusual Aerial Phenomena or something like that. It was the title of his lecture. And I went through the line afterwards. He was saying there were mirages, funny clouds, you know, and so forth, reflections or whatever. I went through the line, shook his hand, and I said, you know, Dr. Clarke, I very much enjoyed your lecture, but both you and I know you're a goddamn liar. and that these ships are man-made ships powered by electricity. I said, you can't fool me. I've seen one up close, so don't run while they're trying to convince me. You know, and he just smiled and said, well, nice meeting you. And
yeah, it went all right.
You know,
when you saw this thing up close, where was that? Can you tell me?
In Kermit, which is just, you know, I don't know how many miles, maybe 100 miles from here, something like mm-hmm. that, just across the Texas border. And this thing did a couple. It was precessing wildly. We were having an ice cream party in the backyard, and this thing was only about 250 feet away, and it was around 50 feet in diameter. It had striations on the hull that I believe were early stealth technology, the testing they were trying to develop, stealth technology. And it's similar. See, the Germans used on their subs to try to defeat the radar. They welded beads on their conning towers. Welding beads, so it create little troughs and so forth to break up the radar reflections. And so I figured that this saucer was an attempt to create a stealth saucer. And this was in 1953. This thing did 290-degree, speeded up the precession, decreased in angle, and became a very rapid vibration, and then it did two 90-degree turns, and I counted 1,001, 1,002, 1,003 as it disappeared on the horizon. Now, there were seven people in our watching this, including not including the neighbor's daughter who was hanging over the back fence. That was Alan Pike's daughter. He was like a Heisman Trophy winner. But our tenant, Mrs. Humphreys, had been U.S. Army Air Corps Chief of Gunnery Instruction mm-hmm. in Sarasota, Florida during World War II. So she was definitely one of the first people to see the Foo Fighter films coming out of 8th Air Force. And when I spotted the saucer, I screamed, "Look at that." She didn't look, she just glanced at it, and then she watched me while I watched the saucer. And so I think probably she was probably a Army CIC intelligence agent that was stationed in our town posing as her husband was a tool dresser. And I think she was just there just to observe things in the area. And this thing could have been a staged sighting just to get my reaction. Is that crazy? Because she was watching me, and it's almost like, oh, you got to believe this is alien, you know. And I'm seeing it heading on a beeline for Fort Bliss, due west. If you went due west from that spot, you would hit Fort Bliss. And, of course, this is where Von Braun was stationed in 1945 as a new chief of U.S. Army Ordnance. But what I feature in my book is Von Braun was here before the war for 2 years. And a lot of people have doubted that. Well, I had it right straight from the horse's mouth. My friend Peter Van Dresser was the inventor of the first successful liquid fuel rocket engine, not Goddard. Goddard got credit for his invention, which was very disturbing to Peter. But Peter was here before the war, and in fact, Von Braun's teacher was Willie Ley. And Willie Ley was invited by the American Rocket Society to come work in New Mexico. And he stayed with Peter in Florence in Greenwich Village. And he defected, fell in love with and married a German ballerina named Olga Feldman, and then applied for American citizenship. So the German high command had to come up with another spy to send, and that was Wernher von Braun. So he was cranked up in rank. He was projected up to the chief of rocket research in Germany at the age of about 21. He suddenly finished his PhD very fast and was sent over here to replace Ley. And he came and he worked with Goddard at Mescalero and Eden Valley, but he was running a secret project at Los Alamos, which according to the Los Alamos crowd is there was nothing there but a boys ranch, but that's a lie. The name of the project was P2, small p, large 2, and that was a German UFO project run by Von Braun here in this country. They brought their own crew with them, and it was based on Tesla technology. And for a long time I thought, well, they must have stolen the technology from Tesla, and then I reconsidered it, and I believe that Tesla sold it to him in 1914 when he sold his submarine technology to the Germans because the U.S. government had no interest in it.
You were talking last night, I think, in detail about Tesla.
Yes.
Interesting man. Why don't you flesh out for our audience a little bit about what you talked about there about him? And then I want to get back to this Los Alamos crowd, because I really think that a lot of the action has been going on there instead of other places.
Well, if you look at all these bases, all of these bases mm-hmm. have a specific role. Los Alamos is scientific research and development. Sandia Base is Army weapons.
Yes.
So they fit UFOs with weaponry.
Right.
And White Sands Missile Range is a test range or an impact range in case of rockets, but in case of UFOs, they probably test UFO weapons down there. And Alamogordo, Holloman, has been an advanced UFO interceptor base since the 50s. And this is where most of the flying saucers that I was seeing were coming from, out of Holloman. But some of them were coming from White Sands Missile Range and Fort Bliss, which is where Von Braun was stationed until 1950. And then he took over Redstone. He went to Redstone Arsenal from there. But they still had UFO projects at Fort Bliss. And I believe the saucer that I saw in 53 was an early American prototype. The ones that my mother saw in 1950 and the whole town witnessed over Kermit were early German
types. That's in Texas, too.
Yes, yes. It was right across from our house. This thing was hovering. Well, there was one on this was June, I think it was June the 1st, 1950, whatever the first day of the Korean War was. That was the day the first one appeared. And then the next day there were two there, and I wasn't there to witness it. I was in the Davis Mountains, unfortunately. But they got 45 minutes of viewing time. And my friend Ken Burroughs got photographs, and he was only 13 years old at the time. And in a couple of days, the Air Force OSI showed up, purchased his photographs for $250 and the negatives, and made him sign a non-disclosure agreement. And later, after I published my books, he heard about me talking about him shooting these photos, and he contacted me from he lives out in Nevada. Anderson, Nevada, and he says, well, he doesn't remember it. He wouldn't deny that he didn't take the photographs, but he didn't remember it. I said, look, Ken, how could a 13-year-old kid forget
getting $250
from OSI? And it turns out that in 1962, Ken was in Laos on covert operations for the CIA. So you see how this system works. So I said, did they wipe your mind? He said, they might have. Maybe they did, you know.
Yeah.
But he was the last person in the world I ever thought would be involved in something like, covert operations, because he was the kind of kid that came to school in slacks and starched white shirts and never wore Levi's.
Yeah. I understand. We have one of those stiff shirt guys on our staff, and he's actually got probably the best mind about conspiracies I know of. So looks can be deceiving.
Yeah.
you're a native of New Mexico, and you know.
Well, of Texas.
Of Texas, but.
But I've been here about 36 years.
Well, so. You might as well be a native.
Yeah, and I have relatives that lived up here and were old timers.
New Mexico, I guess, the reason I'm asking this, and New Mexico early on was. Pretty desolate place, so it was a good place for the government to do these things, I guess.
That's the reason they brought all these German projects to New Mexico. Now, my friend Helen, whom I knew in Austin, was brought here in around 1950, somewhere along in there, as a security agent at the age of 15 years old. She spoke six languages. She came from a highly connected German family. Her grandfather supplied horses in the First World War. Her father supplied gun stocks in the Second World War, and she owned a castle somewhere over on the Austro-Hungarian border or somewhere that the government bought from them in anticipation of the days when the Iron Curtain would come down and they'd have that nice castle to use for tourists. She was brought over here as a security agent. She knew Von Braun very well, and she told me that there were 15,000 people in her contingency that were brought to New Mexico. 15,000.
15,000.
Now, that's never been confirmed by the government, but she was part of the project, so she knew how many people were there. And a lot of people, there have been other allegations of this same type of situation, not counting the 115 scientists they had brought under paperclip to Alamogordo. But the monkeys that were used on the Roswell, what I call the Roswell hoax, were rhesus monkeys, because they used rhesus monkeys up until 1950, and then they switched over to chimps because chimps are a lot easier to handle. Rhesus monkeys are pretty violent, and they'll scratch you. I got clawed by one when I was a kid, and it got very infected. But they're harder to handle. They had
let's talk a little bit. Why was there a Roswell hoax? What was the deal there?
Well, everyone was seeing UFOs around here. I mean, I had heard about them in 1946 from oil field pumpers, and my friend Elmer said, well, that was a Tesla discovery, because he grew up in the Cimarron territory in Colorado. And he was there. He was a radio man, and he was there when Tesla was doing these experiments. And so he knew about Tesla for certain. He said that was a Tesla invention. So the oil field pumpers were describing these as flying discs. They would come up to New Mexico to maintain pumps out in the oil fields. So I was very curious. I started sleeping in the yard at night to try to get a look at these things. And I would see whole squadrons of them coming out of New Mexico in a line, and they would turn in 30-degree increments, or even, 30, 60, 90, 180. They could just totally reverse. They were very high altitude. And so I assumed these were German pilots training American pilots. I mean, I never once thought these things were alien ships. And there was a number of leaks that occurred in the area. My parents would pick up information in bridge games with people from Alamogordo or Roswell. And one of the things was that I asked a little kid, right, I was interested in aircraft from the time I was 3 years old. And I was building model UFOs powered with airplane engines and stuff like that. And the lady I said was our tenant, she was very attentive at what I was doing, building these little UFOs and doing Tesla coil experiments and electrical experiments too. So she figured, well, maybe she figured this kid might figure it out. So, you know, these things were...
Let's say your theory is right, and you're an intelligent man. You've been connected to things, so I'm not going to question you on your ability to figure facts. But why did they use the monkeys here in Roswell to? I mean, were they trying to say they were ETs?
They were testing. What they were doing is determining the parameters of acceleration. They were using these monkeys on the rocket sled, for example, and they made G-suits for them because, you know, to help them to withstand more accelerations, pull more Gs. And my friend Merrill Holste in Albuquerque was the inventor of the G-suit, and they took his invention away from him and just handed it over to some corporate guy. You know, he worked over in Alamogordo. They had the Primate Research Center over there, which actually evolved out of this research with the acceleration experiments. And somebody, one of my readers or somebody, came up actually with the footage of the rhesus monkeys being used on the rocket sleds. And they had to make, you know, little space suits and things for oxygen.
Well, I remember seeing pictures of rocket sleds and monkeys on it when I was a kid from somewhere.
Yeah, that's where I got the information.
Uh-huh.
And then I had the photographs. I got the photographs of the Roswell hoax monkeys that were sent out by Walter Hout. Walter Hout mailed out these photographs in this press release to area newspapers. It wasn't intended to be a big national or international event. They were just trying to convince people in the area that, oh, no, these aren't from the government. These are from outer space, you know. So, you know, what they did in Kermit, they had a sighting, and then the OSI shows up and buys the photographs. What kind of message does that send? Oh, the government wants to know about these things. But in fact, what it is we pulled this to get your reaction, and we want to create the impression we don't know about it.
We'll be right back. I know you have to leave here in a minute, but we maybe get you to hang around for a few more minutes for our next segment. So don't go away. This is Jerry Pippin.
The doors are finally open at shopjerrypippin.com. Explore our new iShop. It's open and growing. You can use any major credit card or your checking account with our PayPal connection. Our first edition t-shirt selections features 3 different Jerry Pippin UFO files designs. In addition, we will be adding collector t-shirts from select UFO conferences, as well as several novelty items. Check us out at shopjerrypippin.com.
This is Jerry Pippin. We're in Roswell, New Mexico, and I think you have a question.
Yes, I was wondering, what was it that Tesla actually invented, the entire UFO, the propulsion system? How does Tesla tie into this?
Tesla stated that that was his main goal in life. He conceived it in 1878 to build the perfect flying machine, and it was to be powered by electricity. And the only thing that held him up was he needed a primary power source of great intensity. I think what happened was Tesla overestimated the amount of power that he needed to run these things. As it turns out, he really didn't need near as much power, and he didn't have to worry about weight, but he didn't find that out until later. What he did is he did research in the 1890s to figure out how to make this work. This was not something that he started, actually. Faraday was trying to figure it out. All these guys in England, all the great physicists, were working on the problem of electrodynamic propulsion. And this was before the airplane evolved. And the only reason the airplane came about first was because they developed an engine that was light enough to get it into the air. Most of the engines were way too heavy The most powerful engine took 2.5 pounds to produce a horsepower, whereas Tesla's turbine would produce 10 horsepowers per pound. So it was, but he didn't really need to worry about the weight, as it turned out. And but he worked out the technology of the electrical pulses.
Why did you say that he didn't have to worry about the weight?
Because it turns out the electromagnetic interreaction is 10 to the 40th power times stronger than gravity. So that means if you take an ordinary force, let's say a gravitational force, convert it, for example, into electromagnetic force, you can do 10 to the 40th power times more work, because it's that much more powerful. So you can just multiply. It's a free energy conversion. When you go from gravitational to electromagnetic, you magnify the energy, you know, zillions of times.
Did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you very much.
And your name?
Craig Fiock.
And you're from the Dallas area, I take it?
Yes, sir.
And what do you think of Roswell here? I know you saw the costume contest.
Oh, it's been a lot of fun. We've had a good time.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Did you know Walter Howe personally?
I had met him in 1997, and he appeared to agree with me because he kept looking at me and shaking his head like this, you know. And, of course, he was an intelligence officer. A PIO is an intelligence officer. And everything that a PIO says has to be
public
clear.
Information officer,
yeah,
is what you're talking
that's
about.
That's an intelligence officer. He's part of an intelligence division. And everything that he released had to be cleared. It was written up and cleared by his superiors. He's just the guy that releases it to the public. So when he released that information, it was approved by his superiors. But yet they pulled it back. They freaked out when they saw those photographs because they realized that somebody would see those photographs and realize they were hoaxes, that they were rhesus monkeys, even though they're dressed up in space suits and they were shaved and tinted green. Of course, that didn't appear in the photographs because they were black and white. But they, when I was a child, a boy of, let's say, 9 or 10 years old at that time, 1947, I was 9 years old. They came down to our store. The spooks came down to our store and bought the pigment to tint those monkeys from me. I'm the one that they wanted to know what they could do to create a green tint.
They wanted to make them look like a little green man?
Yeah. And I sold them some Prang dry temper. I said, we use this stuff to smear onto oak when we want to make what they call limed oak. We smear it on the oak and wipe it, and then we cover it with varnish, and it gives a greenish tint to the oak. So I rubbed some on my arm. I said, see? Now, apparently they'd experimented with paint, and they didn't have any paints available in 1947 that would, you know, you could put on your skin. It was pretty hard to come by in the Southwest. So they came down. We had the only real state-of-the-art decorating and paint supply and art supply in the whole Southwest. I mean, there was nothing in Albuquerque, El Paso, and the nearest you could find something of our caliber would be to go to Fort Worth or Dallas. We were really
well. And now you referred to them as undercover agents, spooks, investigators. How'd you know that?
Just by their attitude. They weren't dressed in the uniform. They were dressed kind of like in tan slacks. You know, uh-huh. Typical. There's telltale signs from these guys. You know, the way they kind of patter themselves on the MI5 guys. You know.
Yeah.
And. And I could tell by the questions they were asking me, questions about the pigment, that they wanted to apply it to skin. They were having trouble making paint give the right, you know, it would be cracked and weird, you know, and it wouldn't have the right effect. So they were trying to tint these monkeys. And I know that they had to shave the monkeys because, like I say, Merrill Holste, my friend, invented the G-suit, and they had to have close contact with the skin to make the G-suit work. With a bunch of hair would interfere with that pressure. So they shaved the monkeys. Now, so there was a lot of things involved. But I got these photographs from a newsman in 1970 that he got out over in Lovington in an old newspaper office. That newspaper there is a member of the Freedom Chain, which was owned by a man named Broyles. And the Odessa American, where he worked, was another member of the Freedom Chain newspapers. And he was over in Lovington for a while, and he found these photos in an old desk in the back. And so what the government did is they pulled all those photos back, but some of them got loose because I saw that same photograph that I had published in a magazine sometime in the 60s. I saw it.
Let's say you're right, because I've had a Special Air Force Office of Security Investigations tell me off the record that they love to go to UFO conventions and confuse the issues. Because if they can get them talking about UFOs, then their projects are protected.
Yeah, I had one suspect last night who tried to divert the thing, started talking about gyroscopes being used, you know, just try to confuse the technology, you know. Now, Tesla definitely developed some special gyroscopic devices because he wouldn't talk about it in 1915 when he was interviewed. He said, I'm not prepared to talk about it as some special device that was a gyro stabilizer. And I believe what it was, from what information I've gotten out of Germany from an old-timer there, is that it was two revolving counter-rotating plates, which one is spinning one way and one spinning the other, so any tendency to precess is counteracted by the other plate, so you have a really stable gyro stabilizer. You have reversing gears in there, of course, and they're spinning opposite directions. And then he used his turbine as a gyro stabilizer on another axis. So here's the turbine spinning this way, and turning a generator creates gyro stability on one axis, and then this covers the other axis. And the idea was to get a really stable ship, and he described this as positive mechanical action. He said his ships could stay absolutely still in the worst storm. There was no danger. You could take off and land anytime you wanted, and, you know, right out of your, technically speaking, out of your backyard.
Well, why don't we use this technology if we have it?
The corporations and the big powers that be don't want us to have the technology. When I asked that question when I was in Air Force Intelligence to a really weird guy that came to visit one day, he was checking me out or something, I could tell he was from OSI, and I asked him about the OSI. He says, oh, the OSI doesn't exist. And, of course, at that time, they didn't acknowledge it. Of course, there's three OSIs. anyway, I said, well, why don't we have this technology available to us? He says, oh, the public's just not ready for it. It's just too far ahead of the public. So basically, they've been dumbing the public down for 60 years, and the technology that the government has is many years ahead of what the public has access to. So whatever they talk about is unclassified already. Anything they mention. So you see the stuff on the stealth planes and stuff, and this is archaic junk. You know, it's the saucer I saw in 53 did about 25,000 miles per hour. And you know, that's so far ahead of anything we know about.
Yeah, it's just incredible to me. I mean, it's almost as hard to accept the story about extraterrestrials from other worlds as it is that we've covered this technology up for 60 years now,
mm-hmm.
Maybe more.
Well, just think. In 1938, the Germans had FM radio. They had stereo.
Yes.
33 and a third RPM records, and they also had something called the Bildplatte, which was a slightly more primitive version of the DVD. You could get a record and play it, and you have a movie. And they tried to release this technology in the United States for years, and they never did. And then finally somebody comes out with a DVD, which is a laser cut, but I think the German technology at the time must have been cut with a diamond needle or something, you know. And how it produced an image, I have no idea, but they were doing it. And so there's an example of technology in one place that was way ahead of, you know, the United States. And the technology I saw in 1957 in Air Force Intelligence was about 35 years ahead of what we have. They would fly a copy of Pravda from Moscow to Westover Air Force Base in Massachusetts and put it in a scanner, and in 2 hours it print out the paper in English, would scan it and print it out in English, translated, and then they would reproduce copies of that and ship them out to all the Air Force bases and 8th Air Force in the world. SAC, all intelligence operations, would get a copy of Pravda, and so by noon that day we could be reading Pravda, you know. And that's, you know, that kind of technology didn't get to the public till, you know, what, about 1990 something, you know, for you know this type of technology.
You know, we could spend a lot of time, and I hope we'll meet again, because as an Air Force intelligence officer,
I wasn't an officer. I was the lowest of the low. The only reason they stuck me in intelligence was to shut me up, because I had uncovered a Soviet spy ring in 1956, which was running the Air Force Career Counseling Center. So what you'd have thought, well, I'd at least got a pat on the back, thanks. They tried to poison me. They did poison me. They damaged my brain. They gave me narcolepsy. I survived. So they stuck me in an intelligence division in Ohio, gave me a top secret clearance, and then continued to abuse me. for the rest of the time I was there. And I was just treated like crap. And the way I look at it, there was only a couple of guys in that whole intelligence outfit that were smarter than me. The rest of them were a bunch of idiots.
We talked about that off the air, so yeah, I'm not going to get into that.
Yeah.
it seems that your story about doing things to our own people, we have that come up all the time, and a lot of people say, oh, that doesn't happen. It does happen. What's the intellect behind this that they can just, like you... You know, they didn't want you talking.
Well, I think Eisenhower was afraid he'd lose the election if the public found out about this. Imagine the KGB takes over the Air Force Personnel Division during his watch. So that was a hot election, you know, between him and Adlai Seuss.
Yeah, right.
A lot
of people don't remember that in 56 at once.
Yeah.
In 52.
And there was a lot of stuff flying around about soft on communism and all mm-hmm. this kind of stuff. Here they were accusing Adlai Stevenson being soft on
right.
communism, and meanwhile the KGB's taken off their air career. And they deny this. I've got a pile of papers that high, FOI papers. They deny everything. I've got papers from the FBI, AFOSI, CIA, you name it, everything, Air Force Intelligence, they all deny that this event ever occurred. And, so I figure it was probably Dick Nixon or somebody who influenced it, and they basically tried to murder me, gave me a bad cup of coffee. And then I went to an infirmary, and they gave me a prescription of Belladonna, and I was taking this stuff, and I didn't realize what was screwing me up. It was totally messing me up. You can't imagine what that stuff could do. I was taking a dosage that was 80 times the maximum dosage.
How'd you survive?
I was walking around like a zombie for about 40 days before I realized, what happened was I quit taking it. It was like you're in lockstep. You're put in, something called, it's called a twilight sleep. So I was like clammy. My eyes were glassy. Everybody was commenting. I couldn't sleep at night. I couldn't get a wake up during the day. I was having sleep attacks. And I went around like this until the dropper wouldn't reach the bottom of the bottle. It was still about half an inch in the bottom of the bottle, so that's when I quit taking it. And I didn't find out this stuff was deadly poisonous until I got out of the Air Force, and an ex-Air Force medic, I mean an ex-Navy medic, saw that and said, "Where'd you get that?" I said, "Well, the Air Force gave it to me." He says, "This stuff's deadly poisonous." So that I went to toxicology books and found out what they were giving me, which was roughly the same thing as the Nazi truth serum. You know, that's what they used on Tesla when they interrogated him and he died. It's the reason they didn't know which day he died. They got 3 dates for his death. It's because the poison created a death-like stupor, and they weren't sure when he was dead or alive, you see. They probably killed him when they interrogated him.
Your book, it's available. People can get it. We have a link on the website to it, and we've enjoyed it. You just opened up a lot of doors we want to follow up sometime.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
The doors are finally open at ShopJerryPippin.com. Explore our new iShop. It's open and growing. You can use any major credit card or your checking account with our PayPal connection. Our first edition t-shirt selections features 3 different Jerry Pippin UFO files designs. In addition, we will be adding collector t-shirts from select UFO conferences, as well as several novelty items. Check us out at ShopJerryPippin.com.